Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk with a pediatrician about the rise in measles cases. What's her advice? Illinois' energy demand will outpace supply in just a few years. That has supporters of using more nuclear power seeing an opportunity. A famous author and anti-death penalty activist goes behind bars to talk to the incarcerated. We'll bring you what happened. Governor J.B. Pritzker has yet to say if he'll seek another term, but all signs point to him considering a bid for the presidency. We'll have a report. We'll also learn more about the Muslim community in central Illinois. And with concerns among immigrants over their ability to stay in the country, many are rushing to get U.S. citizenship. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Dr. Allison Croucher is a Chicago-area pediatrician with Dooley Health and Care. She recently spoke with reporter Maureen McKinney about measles, a disease which is on the rise both nationally and here in Illinois.
What is your opinion of this situation where measles is an issue when it really hadn't been previously?
I think it is unfortunately becoming an issue because of the increase in parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their children. Measles is such a highly contagious illness that really the only way to prevent it is, one of the only ways to prevent it is vaccination. So I think that's really why we're seeing the uptick in disease.
What are the symptoms of measles?
So measles can be kind of tricky because the first couple days, the main symptoms are fevers, runny noses, cough, some loss of appetite. Some kids and adults will have watery eyes, or the medical term for that is conjunctivitis. But it can look a lot like any other common virus that's out there. Typically, it's not until about days 5, 6, maybe even day 7 that the rash will begin. And that rash typically starts around the face, up at the hairline, and then will move down the body, covering the neck, the trunk, and eventually can cover the entire body. And that's one of the really tricky things, as mentioned, about measles, is because for the first couple of days, you might not even realize that it is measles. It acts like another illness.
And what is the course of treatment?
So there isn't any specific treatment to treat the measles itself. So it's not like a bacterial illness. Measles is a viral illness, and there is no antibiotic or antiviral medicine that we have to treat measles directly. There are some treatments we can do to help people who have measles, to support any issues they're having with hydration, treating the fevers symptomatically with things like Tylenol or Motrin, ibuprofen products. Children who get hospitalized may end up getting support for any breathing issues that develop or hydration. And there's some evidence that giving vitamin A in children who are sick to the point of being hospitalized may benefit them, but it's not something that's routinely done in children with measles. So unfortunately, there is no specific one treatment to get rid of measles.
As far as, if I'm counseling a patient, I always recommend the vaccination. So we always talk in depth about, the benefits of the vaccine, including the two-dose series. And then I've had a lot of patients recently asking about giving it early or things like that. So we've been counseling a lot of families. People don't often realize they have measles until a couple days into the illness. So it makes prevention even harder because it can look like a more typical viral illness until the rash shows up. So people might not even realize that they're spreading measles until it's too late.
How serious is the disease?
Measles is quite serious. Prior to vaccination, it was a big cause of hospitalizations, disability, and unfortunately death for some children. I think it's 3 out of 10 people will get some sort of complication from measles, whether it's ear infections, pneumonias, or something much more significant like encephalitis. So I think there's a lot of miscommunication out there with people thinking that it is a fairly mild illness, where in reality, it can have some very serious consequences.
Do you know how long the vaccine has been offered?
The first vaccine that was released was between 1963 and 1967 when it became widespread. I have parents of a lot of younger children, children who are too young to yet receive the vaccine, asking, and then also children who are fully vaccinated. I have those parents, you know, wanting to confirm that their child is protected and asking what they can do. So we've had lots of talks about avoiding sick people in general. You know, if they're traveling, trying to avoid large crowds, masking when they can. It's not always possible. Children under two cannot safely mask. It has previously, to be totally honest, had been more of a travel question. Now it's that I've seen an uptick in just people asking about what they can do locally. And like I said, unfortunately, because it is so contagious and there aren't a whole lot of other prevention measures, it's really just avoiding sick people the best you can. So we typically recommend a 2-dose vaccine series. The first dose is routinely given between 12 and 15 months of age. And the second dose is typically given between 4 and 6 years of age as part of the kindergarten prep process. But really, the second dose can be given as early as 28 days after the first dose. For parents who are concerned and want to get their kids truly protected, they can get that dose even 4 weeks after the first one. And the first dose provides about 93 to 94% immunity. And the second dose provides about 97 to 99% immunity. The vaccine can be given as early as 6 months, though this vaccine does not provide the same kind of lifelong immunity. So it is still recommended that children receive the routine 2-dose series after 12 months of age. Please stress that families talk to their pediatricians about the vaccine. Their pediatricians are the best source of information. If they do think their child potentially has measles, I highly recommend that they call their pediatrician and discuss those symptoms. Because it is so contagious, most pediatric offices are not having the patients with potential measles coming in at the same time as other potentially vulnerable children, whether they're like too young to get vaccinated or then possibly immune compromised. So I recommend that they make that phone call and discuss any of the concerns they have, whether about the immunization or the disease, directly with their pediatrician.
That's Dr. Allison Croucher, a Chicago area pediatrician with Dooley Health and Care. And she spoke about the rise in measles cases, both nationally and here in Illinois. Despite the Muslim population in the U.S. being relatively small, Muslims in central Illinois and Springfield have fostered strong ties and are secure in their identity as Muslims and Americans. The ties have been reinforced by difficult events and challenges over the years. As part of the Healing Illinois project, Healing Through Narrative Change, Untold Stories, Amina Rahman reports in the heart of Springfield's Muslim community.
Springfield, Illinois is home to a resilient and tightly knit Muslim community, one that's quietly shaped the capital through interfaith outreach and service.
An estimated 4.5 million Muslims live in the U.S., yet 40% of Americans have never spoken to one, according to the Public Religion Research Institute. Last year, anti-Muslim hate crimes were the highest since data has been kept, including the tragic killing of 6-year-old Wadi al-Fayumi in Bolingbrook.
But in Springfield, a different story is unfolding, one of unity, healing, and quiet impact. Manas Habib, a longtime Springfield resident and interfaith leader, remembers when being visibly Muslim meant facing stares and sometimes worse. Today, she's one of the many helping to reshape the narrative through outreach and dialogue.
Places of worship were opened up to our community where we met, we prayed, we had community potlucks. Over the 4 years it took to construct our current mosque on Stanton Avenue.
That community spirit doesn't end with adults. Children from different faiths also come together thanks to programs designed to foster understanding from a young age.
Children from all faith groups are invited to get to know each other, to visit each other's houses of worship, and they meet about 5 times a year. Often our meetings involve a service project, a craft project, and they enjoy a vegetarian meal at the end of it.
This sense of community has left a lasting impact on young Muslims who have grown up in Springfield, like Ayana Kadim.
I would say overall, growing up in the Muslim community here was quite fun and an enriching experience. Our community was small and diverse, really tight-knit, And we have people from all over. Growing up, my closest friends were like African-American, Native American, Thai, Jordanian and American, Bengali, Pakistani.
Ayana's story reflects what a 2022 study revealed. Illinois has the largest Muslim population per capita in the U.S., and that population is incredibly diverse. 35% Black, 31% Asian, 23% White, 8% Hispanic, and 4% identifying as other ethnicities.
In Springfield, this diversity is more than numbers. It's a source of strength and a catalyst for connection. The Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, also known as ISOGS, has been central to that effort, organizing everything from interfaith dinners to educational workshops. Religious leaders from different backgrounds collaborate regularly, underscoring shared values like generosity, service, and neighborliness. Dr. Yahya Zeno, a physician and president of the ISOGS board, sees that diversity firsthand.
Springfield has a diverse Muslim population that has been expanding over the last few decades. We have Muslims from all different backgrounds, including numerous countries. And also we have Muslims who are native, born and grew up here in Springfield. We have multiple nationalities, Pakistan, from Syria, from Arab people, from Africa and Albania, European people from Yemen. And also we have a lot of people who were born here and they went to school here. Some of them went far to different states and came back to Springfield. You can meet a lot of people who are here in Springfield.
Beyond who makes up this community is the question of how they see themselves. Not just as Muslims, but as empowered American citizens.
First of all Muslims in Springfield, they want to keep their identity. They want to raise their kids up in a way they are Muslims. They are able to practice their religion freely. And also, they need to learn how to read the Quran. They want all of that. And they need to establish these educational programs that default back home. But here, it's a little bit different. There is more challenge because we have to establish these educational programs for them. They have to feel proud, both Muslims and also American citizens. It's very important for them to feel this way. So we want them to be empowered.
In a time when hate often dominates headlines, the Muslim community in Springfield offers another narrative, one of hope, resilience, and belonging. Through faith, service, and deep-rooted relationships, they are helping to bridge divides and build a stronger, more united city.
More of that series coming up later this hour on Statewide. Illinois' energy demand will outmatch its supply by 2030. That's according to a Power Bureau study, and it's why some Illinois lawmakers are trying to end a 40-year ban on the construction of large-scale nuclear reactors. Eric Stock reports a bill to end the moratorium seems to have widespread support, yet it is stalled as the end of the spring session draws near.
There's increased demand for artificial intelligence and their data centers, so that has raised concerns that Illinois could run out of power. The state of Illinois has a goal to be carbon-free by 2050, and some lawmakers and advocates see nuclear energy as the best way to meet its energy goals without doing more damage to the environment through greenhouse gas emissions. Currently, Illinois has the most nuclear energy capacity in the country, with 11 nuclear reactors at 6 power plants, including the plant in Clinton, about a half hour south of Bloomington-Normal. Clinton produces about 1,100 megawatts of electricity that can power 800,000 homes. 2 years ago, state lawmakers ended the ban on construction of smaller-scale nuclear reactors. State Senator Sue Resid of Morris, who led the effort, says ending the ban is essential to preventing an energy shortage.
So there are reports out there that are stating that the demand is increasing at a rate that our capacity cannot keep up with. So there's a need for new power to be built out in the state of Illinois.
Now Resin wants Illinois to entirely lift its ban on new nuclear projects. Resin says that needs to be decided soon, since it would take 10 to 15 years to build the power plants. She says passing the bill now could entice nuclear energy companies to come to Illinois.
It sends a message to potential investors who are looking at building or investing in this industry that, yes, Illinois is open for business.
Not everyone is into putting more of the state's focus on nuclear energy. The bill is currently stuck in the Illinois Senate as environmental groups work with Illinois lawmakers to come up with a plan they can live with. One of the opponents is the Illinois Environmental Council. Executive Director Jen Wallig says the organization has concerns about the cost of new power plants, noting projects in other states like Georgia which took longer to build and cost more than anticipated.
If we build a large nuclear facility, or if there's an expansion of current nuclear facilities, how long will it take to help meet our capacity needs, and how much is it going to cost?
Wallach also says she has concerns about the waste produced by the nuclear plants. The responsibility of securing the waste is up to the federal government, but Wallach says she doesn't trust the Trump administration to regulate this.
I would want to see fully staffed government agencies to ensure that everything is done correctly, and that, you know, we're not going to see any accidents or disasters or any type of pollution from building it.
The Trump administration fired about 300 nuclear staff in February, then moved to rehire them after realizing some were responsible for overseeing the U.S.'s stockpile of nuclear weapons. Jen Wallach with the Illinois Environmental Council says there needs to be more state regulatory workers to ensure any new nuclear projects are safe. Wallach says Illinois should focus more on renewable energy, as she says it's cheaper and quicker to build.
And you see states like Texas, states like Iowa, building so much wind energy because it is the cheapest. I think that there can be reliability concerns, but it's at a much higher percentage of production of renewable energy. And that's where we're going to need to supplement renewable energy.
But Wallach says she understands there are likely enough votes in both chambers in Illinois to expand nuclear energy. Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he wants to see an expansion of nuclear, but is not committed to signing the bill. The bill seems to have broad support in the state legislature, yet it missed a key deadline as lawmakers are still working out a compromise with environmental groups that are opposed to any expansion of nuclear energy. Since lawmakers did not vote on the bill by the end of last week, lawmakers now need to lump it into a broader energy package. Democratic State Senator William Cunningham co-filed the bill and says he's not deterred by the delay. He says many nuclear advocates and environmental activists are on the same side when it comes to preventing further use of fossil fuel.
In recent times, the biggest environmental hazard we're facing is carbon. And I think a lot of people in the environmental community have come around and have seen that while they might not necessarily be pro-nuclear, they see it as a very important bridge to getting to carbon-free generation.
While the bill is currently stuck in committee, State Senator and sponsor Sue Resin says she's cautiously optimistic the nuclear expansion will pass this spring and will end what she calls Illinois' outdated moratorium. With a reporting from WGLT State Capitol correspondent Cesar Toscano, I'm Eric Stock.
You're listening to Statewide. We'll be listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Clerical abuse survivors are concerned about the election of the Chicago-born Cardinal Robert Prevost as the new pope. Sean Doherty is the board president of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priest, or SNAP. The group is headquartered in Chicago and filed a complaint against Prevost back in March. Doherty, in Rome, spoke with WBEZ host Lisa Labas.
So, SNAP, it filed this complaint in March. What did that complaint say?
That reports coming out of Peru that then-Cardinal Prevost, in fact, covered up sexual abuse within in Chicago and then in Peru. We designated the Vos Testis report under St. Francis or under Pope Francis's roles during his papacy. We filed the complaint with the Secretary of State of the Vatican, Cardinal Parolin, and Cardinal Prevost was one of the first six. We filed six complaints on one day. The first six cardinals that we filed Vos Testis Cardinal Prevost was included in those six Vos Testis report. It has been reported that he has willingly protected priests that did, in fact, sexually assault children under their watch. And for that reason, our view is that he is not qualified to be the pope. In our view, he's not qualified to be a cardinal. He's not qualified to be a bishop, a monsignor, or a priest.
Okay. And now that Cardinal Prevost is Pope Leo XIV, where does this leave your complaint?
In his hands. And, you know, he was the head of the dicastery. You know, Pope Francis set this up, but he didn't set this up that independent investigators investigated these reports against cardinals and bishops and priests. He set it up that other bishops and cardinals investigate, and then they just police their brethren, which is what they have always done from diocese to diocese to diocese. So the question is, you know, in your earlier segment, there was a lot of mention about, he mentioned social justice. No, he didn't mention anything about social justice for past victims of sexual assault of the church, which there are thousands, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of abuse survivors by Catholic clergy all over the globe. And now Pope Leo XIV is in charge of all of that.
So I want to say, you mentioned that you filed this complaint under a decree from Pope Francis that allowed for priests to be investigated. What were your experiences working with Pope Francis on issues of clerical sex abuse?
Unfortunately, we never got to work directly with Pope Francis. Pope Francis never responded to our letter. Pope Francis never met with us. I was during the Vatican summit that Pope Francis held. He called all the bishops and the cardinals of the world to Rome for a Vatican summit on sexual abuse. I was one of 12 fortunate survivors of sexual abuse that were permitted to meet with the commission heads. We traveled the whole way to Rome, and Pope Francis has never met with any representative of the Survivors Network of those abused by priests. We represent tens of thousands of survivors from around the world, and I think that the hierarchy of the Vatican should want to meet with our organization.
I just wanted to ask you, what do SNAP and other advocacy groups want now from Pope Leo XIV regarding clerical abuse issues, other than you just want a meeting?
What we have been calling for three popes now, is a very simple ask. It's an ask that corporate America, global companies all do, and it's a zero tolerance for child rape, which means if you have a priest or a clergy member, a bishop, a cardinal that has been accused of sexual assault of a child or cover up of a child, they should be immediately removed from ministry. They should not be able to represent the Roman Catholic Church, just like they do with priests and cardinals and bishops that steal money. The big news was Cardinal Becciò, who wasn't allowed in the conclave because he was indicted. He was indicted for stealing. They don't indict pedophiles. They move pedophiles, and they move bishops and cardinals that protect pedophiles.
I'm going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry, Mr. Doherty. Sean Doherty, board president of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests.
The Chicago-based American Writers Museum is exploring the intersection of religion and literature in a new programming series. It's delving into a topic that's been a source of inspiration for writers for centuries. And regardless of your religion, spirituality is a central part of life for many Americans. Gary Zydek has more.
There has been talk for a long time about the idea of nuns, people who have no religious affiliation. And there's a very large study that comes out every 10 years from the Pew Research Center that really looks at this topic.
This is Carrie Cranston, the president of the American Writers Museum.
While there has been a growth in that area, and while it seems that a lot of young people are there, so as time goes by, that area may grow, it has somewhat plateaued as far as how many people consider themselves not affiliated with a religion. But not being affiliated with a religion doesn't mean that people don't have religious beliefs that affect and influence them, and it doesn't mean they don't have spirituality or their own belief systems that are maybe influenced by the religion they grew up with and maybe other things that they've touched on. The same Pew Research study asks people about what they believe, what they feel about things beyond their own self. And so in America, that's 92% of Americans have some sort of religious belief, even if 30% of Americans are not affiliated with a religion. It still shows that there is a strong belief system in America, and it's actually larger than a lot of countries. Numerous people from numerous groups have traveled across the globe to come to America because of, very often, religious freedom. And so that leads to a country that is pluralistic in the quantity and types of religions. There are hundreds that are categorized in America. And so, you know, it really is a religious country. And so we have to recognize that is a religious country. How do you get people to understand each other if they are from different backgrounds and different religions? And writers are often the way that people discover that. The autobiography of Malcolm X is probably one of the first books for many Americans my age that gave them a glimpse into the idea of Islam and what that was and what that belief system was about, because much of the journey of Malcolm X in that autobiography is his spiritual journey.
I recently caught up with Cranston at the Michigan Avenue-based museum to talk about his hopes for American prophets, writers, religion, and culture.
We saw an opportunity to explore a theme that is a huge theme in American culture and look at how writers impact that world and our perception of the world of religion and spirituality, and we thought that it would be a great time to do that.
So the connections between religion and literature go back a long way. Is there a scope? Are you trying to tell a comprehensive history, or is it focused more on contemporary literature?
We're going to look at, in some levels, at everything. Like the museum itself, you can't cover all American writing in one breath. Rather than limit the scope, we decided to go pretty broad. So there will definitely be some connection, or a fair amount of connection to the modern world, but we will also be connecting to things in the past. Some of the exhibits that are already here feature writers who are very focused in, you know, what they wrote about, whether that's Mary Baker Eddy and the Christian Science movement, or, you know, different poets of different eras. Those are already things that are covered in the museum, so it was already a topic that's touched on in different areas.
An effort to touch on a spectrum of religions?
Yes. This is not an exhibit that's meant to proselytize or tell anyone what they should or should not believe, but it is definitely something that wants to explore the diversity of American religions and the diversity of American writers and how those things intersect. It's very common that the way people learn about a religion or set of beliefs outside of their own is by reading about it from the perspective of someone else.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Gary Zeidig. This is the Arts Section. I'm talking with Carrie Cranston, the president of the American Writers Museum. The Chicago-based nonprofit is launching a new programming initiative titled American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture, which will include an exhibition set to open this fall. The exhibit will feature a collection of artifacts related to authors who were influenced heavily by religion.
We've been able to work with the estates of some famous writers and some modern writers today who were interested in the topic and are loaning us artifacts that are objects that have a religious significance in some fathom to a writer that is then reflected in the things that they have written, even if they're not people that you think of as a religious writer. So a good example of that is a piece that a collector is loaning to us. Harold Ramis, the writer of Ghostbusters and all these other movies, is relatively well known for having been raised Jewish, but having some strong feelings about Buddhism. And because of that, he actually created something that he called the Chinese Menu of Buddhism. He typed out on a piece of paper some of the major tenets of Buddhism and folded it over like a trifold menu you'd find at a restaurant, and then laminated it and gave it to friends. So there are a number of these that are out there, and a collector is loaning us one of those. And the reason that it's so significant then is that the movie Groundhog Day is a film that has some very deep Buddhist meanings to it. The Buddhist community looked at it as one of the most Buddhist films ever made. And Harold Ramis has been interviewed multiple times, or was interviewed, he's not with us now, but talking about the reaction to that film from not only Buddhists, but from a number of faith groups who looked at it as a reflection of their religion. And thought, oh, you must have been influenced by us and our religious ideas when you were making this movie. And what he realized was that he touched on some real deep spiritual ideas about the world and our place in it that led different religious groups and different spiritualities to think about how does this reflect on us. not something we think about when we think of a comedy movie with Bill Murray about waking up on Groundhog Day. Right. But that's the fact.
And there's a local connection there with Harold Ramis's tie to the... Will there be other local aspects to the exhibit?
There are a couple of other writers who will be featured who have who are local, but a lot of the writers are from all over the country. We have a songwriter from Los Angeles. We have a things that are being loaned to us from the estates of, say, Ursula K. Le Guin or Flannery O'Connor. So, you know, there are going to be a number of things in the exhibit that are going to be really interesting for people to see.
Cranston hopes the new initiative will open some minds.
Like I said, we can't cover every writer. We can't necessarily touch on every religion, but we will talk about a lot of different ones. And I think what it's really about is getting people to understand that they can, you know, listen and learn and discover from writers about what is out there and gain greater empathy, greater understanding, and hopefully greater tolerance.
Do you anticipate groups from, like, religious institutions coming to visit?
Yeah, we're actually very hopeful about that. We've had visits from religious groups before where, you know, churches and synagogues and other organizations have reached out with a tour group, and we're hoping a lot of them will want to come and come to some of these programs and come to this exhibit because we'd love to see groups of people coming through and really expanding their thought processes in this area.
That's Kerry Cranston, president of the Chicago-based American Writers Museum. You can find out more about the new programming series that explores the intersection of religion and literature at the museum's website, AmericanWritersMuseum.org. A few times a year, students from DePaul University join people incarcerated in Cook County Jail for book clubs. Right now, one of the clubs is reading the book Dead Man Walking. Last month, they got a visit from the book's author, the famed anti-death penalty activist, Sister Helen Prejean. Sister Helen was celebrating her 86th birthday. Lisa Curry and Philip brings you inside the women's division at the jail to hear their discussion.
Sister Helen shows early on that she's got jokes. She's sitting in a circle with students from inside and outside the jail talking about how her book was turned into an Oscar-winning movie and an opera. Pretty soon, it's going to be released as a comic.
You know the only thing we're missing? Is the ballet Dead Man Kicking. So if y'all know any people that do ballet, we open.
This is the first time these DePaul students are meeting these women who are incarcerated. And Sister Helen's bit cuts right through the awkwardness. When the laughter dies down, the student facilitator asks the group,
"What do you think makes for an extraordinary story? For me personally, I think that when books have characters that I can, like, really, really connect with."
Then a student from inside the jail, Lisa, says something that makes Sister Helen lean in.
"And as you go through the story, that person kind of unfolds and you see deeper content of their character. That may change your mind. And then maybe by the end of the story, you have a totally different kind of connection to the characters that are unfolding."
So then that unfolding you're talking about, Lisa, that's probably one of the most exciting things in life, is to see that there's a different side to people.
Sister Helen seizes on the point to dive headfirst into her life's work. For 30 years, she has comforted and prayed with people on death row while working to abolish state-sanctioned executions.
"Even in the rhetoric you hear sometime around the death penalty, these people are so dangerous, we can't even put them in prison because they'll kill other inmates. They're natural-born killers wanting to essentialize a person or crystallize them into this essence of evil. And you can never do that with human beings. As human beings can always change."
It's been over an hour, and the DePaul students have to leave for other classes back on campus. But Sister Helen sticks around, scooting her chair close to the women inside the jail.
"So your transformation of yourself is going to be the best example to everybody about how human beings can never be categorized into one act that they've done.
I know that it's not the end of my story, but it's not..."
Lisa's talking about her time inside.
"It's an opportunity to kind of just sit with yourself and allow this experience to hopefully change some things, shake up some things that maybe you had wrong on the outside. And in here you get to to push through that, learn and grow through that, but then also to impact others.
Sister Helen tells Lisa and the other women from inside the jail that they've already had an impact.
This is the best birthday present I can have, y'all. I mean, really, a chance to be with you. I mean, it's very refreshing.
Before leaving, Sister Helen grabs hold of the hands of the women next to her as they stand in a huddle for prayer.
So, praise you, God, by whatever name we call you.
Lisa, Corey, and Philip, WBEZ News.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Even though the Illinois governor, J.B. Pritzker, is being coy about his political future, there's a widening view that he'll seek a third term. But there's also a question about whether he should seek re-election if he's also eyeing a 2028 bid for the White House. Dave McKinney has more details.
For much of the past year, Pritzker's played a cat-and-mouse game about whether he'd seek re-election in 2026. Consider last August. Pritzker was in a Loop Hotel ballroom, talking about his longevity in office with Illinois delegates to the Democratic National Convention.
It seems crazy, but it's true that when I serve out just the end of this second term, I will be the longest-serving Democratic governor in the history of Illinois.
Wow. 9 months later, Pritzker is still noncommittal about seeking a third term. At one point last month, Pritzker even told reporters it was a possibility he might not run again. But at least one top ally, Illinois House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch, believes the governor will seek a third term.
I can only go on what I see. And what I see is someone who's had a very successful two terms as governor and appears to look like he still enjoys the job. You know, so my sense, just from observing him, is that he's going to run for re-election as governor of Illinois.
But should Pritzker seek re-election? There's a growing sense the governor is leaning toward a 2028 presidential bid. He's been upping his national profile as an effective Democratic attack dog against Republican President Donald Trump. And as recently as last month, Pritzker refused to categorically rule out a White House run. But political strategist David Axelrod, who helped engineer Barack Obama's winning presidential campaigns, says Pritzker should think hard about seeking re-election if he's also thinking about the White House.
First of all, third terms are notoriously perilous. Things that can go wrong tend to go wrong in third terms.
Budgets could implode. An embarrassing gaffe or scandal could happen. Or there could be some unforeseen calamity to raise questions about a governor's leadership.
You know, if your attention is divided between running for president, which is a hellacious job in itself, and dealing with crises at home, that is a very difficult balance to strike.
Axelrod says if Pritzker genuinely harbors presidential ambitions, he would benefit more by traveling the country, interacting with voters, and listening than seeking re-election as governor.
It would enrich him as a candidate and give him a head start. So you have to balance the risks and rewards of each decision. And in my view, the risks of running again are greater than the possible rewards.
Pete Giangreco is another Democratic political strategist with extensive experience with winning presidential campaigns. Like Axelrod, Giangreco warns Pritzker may be putting himself and the state at a unique risk if, as a presidential candidate, he's bashing Trump. The president hasn't been shy about retaliating against his perceived enemies.
If you have a guy at 1600 Pennsylvania who wakes up every morning trying to figure out how to screw Illinois because the governor said something, to me, that's like a new dynamic that no one's ever seen before. You can do one or the other. You can govern or you can run for president.
Giangreco says the stakes are too high to do both and that the governor has amassed a strong record already that will play well nationally. But another Pritzker ally, Democratic Senate President Don Harmon, says he hopes Pritzker does appear again on Illinois' ballot next year.
I certainly hope he'll consider running for re-election. I know that there's work left to do. And if the nation calls after that, we can certainly find a way to have that conversation in Springfield.
Harmon believes Pritzker could handle being both a sitting governor and a presidential candidate if he opts for that route. The governor's campaign says he'll make his reelection decision known in the coming months. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
A new analysis shows the Illinois governor's budget office expects fewer revenue dollars for the upcoming fiscal year. The governor's Office of Management and Budget now projects less than $55 billion in revenue, around $500 million less than originally forecasted. Republican State Representative Joe Sosnowski of Rockford says he's concerned the big decrease in revenue could lead to higher taxes to make up the difference.
We saw kind of this decrease in revenue expected coming for a while, and so we expect, obviously, our budget's going to have to reflect that, and we're going to have to look at ways to trim back and live within our means.
The deputy governor for budget and economy, Andy Menar, blames the revenue decrease on economic uncertainty and anxiety fueled by the Trump administration. Earlier in the show, Amina Rahman shared how aware Central Illinois is of our Muslim neighbors. As we continue this series, we hear what living the Islamic life is like for those in Springfield and surrounding areas. Hafsa Rahman brings us this report.
This past March, Springfield's Muslim community observed the holy month of Ramadan, a time of fasting, reflection, and spiritual devotion. From dawn to sunset, Muslims fast not just from food, but from distractions, turning inward to strengthen their faith. But for Muslims, this spiritual grounding extends far beyond 1 month. According to a 2022 study, 70% of Illinois Muslims attend the mosque at least once a month, with 50% going weekly, and Springfield is no exception. During the final 10 nights of Ramadan, the mosque becomes a center of intense prayer and reflection. It's often Springfield community member Hafiz Osama Pervez, who has memorized all 114 chapters and over 6,200 verses of the Quran, who is called on to lead prayers. Those verses from the Quran outline what many Muslims see as a roadmap for success. Have faith, do good, and remind others to stay truthful and patient. It's a message that resonates year-round for those striving to live out good values in their everyday life. For Muslim converts, that journey can be especially personal. Springfield native John Crago had to change deeply rooted habits when he converted to Islam, including how he and his family ate meals.
Because I'm a convert who takes halal food seriously, I had to personally re-engineer all of my favorite foods. It took me a while to recreate my version of Joe Rogers. After a good solid 3 years, I came up with the recipe. I was the only option for the family. I'm imitating Springfield chili. I'm imitating what I feel to be the best of the best.
For many Muslims in America, faith and identity are deeply intertwined. A 2022 study found that 84% of Illinois Muslims say their religion is central to who they are. A separate 2016 study found that those who feel connected to their faith are also more likely to strongly identify as American. That combined sense of identity is something Shaista Sheikh, who moved from India to Springfield 24 years ago, has embraced and now works to instill in her children.
I want them to be confident no matter where they go. They are Americans who follow Islam, and their parents are from India. Teachers in 186th District, they not only saw me as my identity, but also helped me navigate the culture.
Longtime resident, educator, and mother, Sawad Suleiman, also reflects on how the younger generation expresses its faith in new ways, and how that's prompted her to grow too.
I can practice my religion freely and enjoy it, actually. I think the most that I love is that I can practice, I can wear my hijab, I can do everything. I really enjoy practicing my religion here. I really enjoy being here. Inshallah, we have a lot of younger generation. They express themselves different than us. But then when you put yourself in their place, it does make sense for them. I have changed a lot since I started.
The younger generation is staying deeply connected to their faith, particularly in Springfield. Ali Azim, a University of Illinois Springfield student and leader of the Muslim Student Association, credits Springfield's strong sense of community for helping her deepen her understanding of Islam and its teachings.
For me personally, I used to live in Indiana. Compared to Springfield, I feel like Springfield is way more connecting than how it was in Indiana. There's more of a community feeling here. And I think the community here makes a good effort to get together, do activities and events, which I didn't really experience that much when I lived elsewhere.
In Springfield, faith isn't just observed. It's lived, shared, and passed on to the next generation. For NPR Illinois, this is Hafsa Rahman.
That's Hafsa Rahman, who, along with her mother Amina, are part of the NPR Illinois Citizen Journalist team. Their four-part series is part of the Healing Illinois Project, Healing Through Narrative Change, Untold Stories, an initiative of the Illinois Department of Human Services and the Field Foundation of Illinois that seeks to advance racial healing through storytelling and community collaborations. It's managed by Press Forward Springfield. We'll have more on that series coming up next week on the show. In Illinois, nearly 400,000 legal permanent residents or green card holders are eligible to become U.S. citizens. Getting U.S. citizenship is difficult and expensive, and many legal permanent residents end up putting it off for years. But now, because of President Donald Trump's attacks on immigrants, many people are in a rush to become naturalized. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan has more in this report.
Maria and her husband, Francisco, have been legal permanent residents for years. In recent weeks, they've been studying for a citizenship test at a local elementary on the southwest side. The exam is one of several requirements to get naturalized. They have to memorize questions about U.S. history and government, like who wrote the Declaration of Independence,
Thomas Jefferson,
or name the U.S. war between the North and the South. Maria is 57 and Francisco is 65. We're not using their full names to protect their privacy. Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric and his administration's threats to legal permanent residents are pushing the couple to become citizens. Francisco says, I've been a resident for 35 years. I want to get citizenship to live peacefully here. Maria says, I trusted that I could renew my green card every 10 years. Now the new government is scaring us. Anytime the administration could say, we're not renewing your green card anymore. The federal government has been saying permanent residents are only guests in the U.S. It has threatened to revoke green cards if people break the law or are a public safety threat. And the Trump administration has been targeting green card and visa holders for things like advocating for Palestinian human rights, claiming that counts as supporting terrorism.
Pase por aquí, por favor.
Advocates say they've seen an increase of legal residents, like Maria and Francisco, trying to get naturalized this year.
99 people, great, and it's only 11.
Nancy Sandoval helps organize citizenship application drives for green card holders. One of these events happens every month at Instituto del Progreso Latino on the southwest side.
It's getting more packed.
Sandoval is with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrants and Refugee Rights. She says this used to be a harder sell. People are intimidated by the civic and English language exams. And applying for naturalization means submitting to another background check and answering questions like,
have you ever been arrested? Did you ever enter the U.S. illegally? Have you ever been stopped or had any immigration issues?
Sandoval says everyone should seek legal help before applying. Despite how hard it can be, more green card holders are finding the courage to go through the process before the Trump administration makes it even harder. Lucia Martel-Dow with the New Americans Campaign says the administration is considering two frightening changes.
One of them is collect additional social media information.
She says that's very concerning.
We don't know what kind of surveillance or how the government is going to interpret the social media information.
The administration also wants to start asking for additional information about family members. That could mean if you are living with someone without legal status, you are putting your family member at risk if you apply for citizenship.
Especially siblings, for example. So it is concerning because if you live in a mixed status family, then that obviously has an issue around enforcement.
Francisco and Maria have submitted their application before any of those changes go into effect. Now they have to pass the civics exam. Francisco says, my memory is not very good, so it's been hard. But Maria is confident he'll do good. She says every time she leaves for work and every time she comes home, he is studying. Adriana Cardona Magigat, WBEC News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Remember, you can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.